So we're heading toward spin models for Thursday and Friday, and I wanted to. So some of the stuff we're going to do a little bit is a bit today is a little bit mean field, maybe not as exotic, and then tomorrow and Friday we'll do some pretty more exotic stuff. And I'm hoping to get to talking about matrix product states in the context of a pretty interesting spin model. And we can maybe even if that's interesting enough, we can go on even to like Monday, maybe Tuesday about some of that, about matrix product states, I mean. So what I wanted to do is set up a little bit of something that we're also going to maybe apply to the Heisenberg spin chain, because we'll look at that as a precursor of some other, I want to kind of go through some different typical cases of spin physics. But today, let's talk about some spin and charge physics. So let's think about the Hubbard model a bit at weak coupling. So let's think about, what happens when this just isn't there. So what's our starting point, right? So, and let's think here, we're mostly going to be talking about half filling. So again, this is, and these, here I'm just drawing sites, and these could be in 1D or in more dimensions, just generically. Just think about putting one electron on each site. And here I'm drawing them in some staggered spin state, but I'm not implying that's exactly what the system does if you let it find its ground state. That's just maybe how you start it out. So when u equals 0, we return back to some band theory. Just meaning that we go to momentum space and we fill levels. But here we're on a lattice, right? So there can be details about the band structure that can matter. There can be basically lattice effects. And we'll see one of these very strongly in 1D. So here's what the T-only Hubbard model would look like in 1D, right? So we have our first Baron zone, and then we fill doubly. This is again half filling, right? So we double fill all these states from minus KF up to KF, and KF turns out to be pi over 2. Just that comes from the fact that we're half filling. So you just basically count how many states. It's easiest to do this if you go to a finite size ring and just count, how many states are in here. They're spaced by 2 pi over L, and then you just do some counting and figure out how far does that push the Fermi surface out. Okay. Then we have other cases, like in 2D, say the square lattice at half filling. Then we get a Fermi surface that looks like this. So all these are filled. Okay. There we can write that H0, the one that only involves T, is a sum over momenta, and we have a band structure like cosine kx, cosine ky. Here, the spin sum is already included in this N. And then there's even other interesting cases, like in 2D, you can have the honeycomb lattice. And there you have a Brouwer zone that can look like this, some kind of hexagon. And you actually, so here, this is a bipartite system, which means that if you look at the lattice, I'm not going to go way in depth about this, but you can label, you can start by labeling some site A and the next one B. And then you can see that B sites are only neighbored by A sites and also vice versa. So A sites are only neighbored by B sites. So the unit cell has two sites in it, right? That's the translation invariant unit. It's another way of saying it is it's not a Bravais lattice, right? Or that's a related statement that this is like a decorated Bravais lattice, right? So if you think of this point, this is a Bravais lattice that looks the same in every direction, but here it's, you take it and you decorate it with two other sites. And so for that reason, you get two bands. So you end up filling the whole Brouwer zone at half filling, meaning if you put, one electron on each site, and then the Fermi surface gets pushed out to these corners. But it's a little more subtle than that because the Some of these corners are related by reciprocal lattice vectors. So really, there's just two inequivalent points. So the ones I drew as open circles is one type, and then there's another type, which are these dark circles. So what you end up with is something that looks like two kind of little tents that are touching at points. You know, I mean, I have five fingers here. There's only, yeah, I don't have six fingers, but it would look like a tent where they're touching at points, right? And then you have this thing is like a semi-metal. It's kind of interesting in the sense that, you know, a metal, you know, we have a large Fermi surface. Here there is a Fermi surface, but it's sort of reduced to some points, right? So this is an interesting story. And even more interesting is if you linearize the spectrum around these points, or if you just zoom in on these points, I mean, the spectrum, the energy spectrum is linear, like two cones. So it actually looks like relativistic in some sense, right? That's kind of cool. So that's an example of emergence where you have something that looks like relativistic physics coming out of something that otherwise is some kind of solid state model, you know. Okay, some non-relativistic model. This is just some words, but we're not going to go into that too much. Okay, so that's just saying, you know, what's the starting point at very weak coupling? Let's jump all the way to the other side to really, really strong coupling. So let's talk about what happens. So we're going to basically, you know, sort of first make a huge jump. We're going to say, you know, turn U off, and then we're going to say turn T off. Then we're going to be a little bit more subtle. We're going to say, let's go back to the small t case and start introducing a little bit of U and ask what happens in a second. But first, let's jump to the so-called atomic limit, say. That's one way of describing this, where we have atoms, which in this case are just sites, so they're really just orbitals. So, I mean, I'm putting this in quotes. But we just have a bunch of, you know, sites that aren't talking. So this is this, you know, this is what we have U only, right? What happens? Let's see what the system wants to do in that limit. Let's just observe a few things about it. So of course, as written, it looks like so we can just focus on a single site, right? Because the sites aren't talking with each other. So as written, it just looks like what U does is it just says don't doubly occupy sites, right? But so basically it's just saying, you know, empty site is fine. It's saying, you know, a site with one electron is fine, but two is bad, right? It's just penalizing that. So that seems kind of obvious from the way it's written. But I think it's nice to see there's another way of writing this term that brings out some other physics, right? Especially when you look at it more holistically. So here, you know, this is just focusing on one site. We can also say, what about the fact that we're actually have a fixed number of electrons that we have to now distribute amongst all the sites, right? Again, without T, but there's still something a little interesting that comes out. So let's see this other view of what U wants as follows. So let's take this term and sort of rewrite it three different ways. Okay, so just take this ni up, ni down. I'm changing it to j just so I can follow my notes better. All right. Okay, so step one is switch these guys, right? And they're same spin, so you get this one, and then you get a minus sign for switching them. Okay, that's the usual commutation relations for fermion creation and annihilation operators. Now, move this guy past over here, okay? And when you do that, you get okay, so this is also giving us a little bit of practice with these mappings from fermion operators to spin operators, right? So remember, we define these spin operators by wedging Pauli matrices in between, you know, C dagger alpha, C beta, that kind of thing. So here, this is some operator that on site J acts on a state with a downspin and flips it to an upspin. You know, you could even put the polymatrix there if you want, the S plus or the sigma plus one, and you know, you get this definition. Okay, so that's just an equivalent rewriting of this operator. All right. Rewriting number two is similar. Won't go through it in as much detail. Just write out the answer. So you can also argue that this is equal to this operator, where now that's a down density operator. Okay. And then finally, you can show that this one takes a slightly bit more work, and we won't go through it. That this is the total density on that site over 2 minus 2 SZJ squared. Okay. If you want to show this, it's worth mentioning if you want to work this out, because I think it would be good for you guys to try working this out. You need to use the fact here that NJ up squared as an operator is just NJ up again, and similar for down, I'll just write sigma. So if you choose one of the spin density operators, right, we're working with the Hilbert space of fermions on sites, and so there can only be at most one in a given orbital labeled by J and a spin, right? So as an operator, this thing must just be like a projector. And you know, we're also using the definition of SZ, of course. So right, so that just measures the imbalance and population of the two spin states. So just if you use that, that's how you get this result. But it's a little bit of a mess to do, right? So if we combine these three results, and sum over all the sites. So even though the sites aren't talking, it's illuminating to sum this over all of them. And you'll see why. OK, I'm skipping over a little bit of extra work. But you can show that when you combine these three results together, right? And this, that if you use a few more identities on spin operators, you get this form, right? So something that's useful to know is when you see, that's right, they're the same. It's just three different rewritings of the same operator, right? But it's none of them are so obvious. Right, so it's just some manipulations of some operators, just different rewritings, right? Because you see that, you know, this is different, but so is this, so it just balances out, okay? You can easily show this, okay? It's just using some facts like things like si.sj, of course, is equal to that's true, right? That's just the definition of the dot product. It's something that you'll use a lot if you work with spin models. Maybe you've already seen this rewriting. It's very handy. Is okay. Commit that one to heart if you're going to do anything with spin models. It's really useful. So you know, here you have something where, you know, let's say you're thinking in the SZ basis. These aren't as nice to work with, but if you are in the SZ basis, S plus and S minus are very nice to work with. Okay, so it's a much nicer representation of S dot S. And S dot S comes up all over the place when you're working with spin models. Okay, so that's that kind of identity is what goes into getting this S squared. So finally, we just do the sum over NJ, and you get this form for this total U term. Okay. And let's remember that, yeah, thanks. Maybe we just take the U out front. Okay. Right. So remember, these are not spin sites. These are Hubbard model sites that could be empty or doubly occupied. So SJ squared can take different values, right? It can be 0 on a vacuum site, or on a site that's doubly occupied into a singlet, or 3/4 on a singly occupied spin-like site, right? So on a local moment site. So what we see is that there's some overall penalty that we can't avoid paying. So there's just some kind of, you know, Hartree kind of like thing in a way. Maybe not Hartree, but you know, it's just basically some overall background energy. And then there's this term, which is interesting, right? So this term, there's two interesting things about it, right? One is that it's clearly spin rotation invariant. Okay. And it wants local moments, right? And so I think it's clearer in this form than in this form, because here, you know, you would say, well, zero is just as good as up and down, right? But here it's really saying, no, no, we want, you know, we want spins to form, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. So I'm just trying to say that this way of writing it, you know, it's not as obvious that it's you have this kind of global spin rotation invariance. That's correct. Yeah, global. Thanks for pointing that out. So, you know, this brings it out more. And then, again, this idea that, you know, at half filling, we want local moment formation, right? So we want to really distribute these electrons among the sites and really put one on each site. Okay. Yeah, I think in this case, it is also locally variant. But overall, yeah, we're not making some statement that there should be some local rotation invariance as much. I mean, just going for global, that's all we need. Right, so that's just, you know, I didn't do anything too fancy there. That wasn't any kind of involved computation, but, you know, just to show different ways of thinking about these two extreme limits, right? Okay. So now let's be a little bit more subtle, right? We're still gonna make some kind of crude arguments, but that was just, you know, totally neglecting either T or totally neglecting U and seeing what happens, right? So let's now think about, at half filling, what happens now if we go back to only having T, but then start introducing a small amount of U, right? So let's work in one dimension, just to make things easier to write, and I can draw better pictures, all right? So just along a 1D chain. And we want to think about starting out with U equals 0, then add small U, okay, relative to T. All right, so we're going to turn on a little bit of U, kind of think perturbatively here, right? And so, you know, so that we don't have to tackle a bunch of complicated, like, perturbation theory machinery, let's cheat a little bit and use something simpler. So let's just use mean field theory, okay. So that just one way of saying what mean field theory is just to say that we take this complicated operator involving four creation and annihilation operators, and we try to see if there's some other operator or sum of operators we can replace it by that is good enough. So we say, so this can be justified a little more carefully, but for our purposes, what we're thinking here is that we want to say, let's treat one of these as a C number. So what we're saying is that instead of having some detailed quantum fluctuations here where we have, you know, kind of Hartree kind of interactions and exchange kind of interactions and even more complicated sort of correlation effects, let's just say that, well, you know, let's just imagine that the down electrons just ignore the up electrons except as they treat them as some classical potential that they move in, right? So they just move in their own sort of down world, and then the up world is sitting next to it, and they just feel some classical Coulomb repulsion from up world, okay? And similarly, you know, up world feels down world, but only at some classical level. And then we do this, you know, we put these terms twice to make things symmetrical, and both feel the other. And then this is some kind of double counting correction up to some mean field level. So we just don't want to we don't want to double our interactions, right? So we have to subtract off something to make sure this is single counted. That's one way of talking about this. There's another way of deriving this form involving fluctuations. And some of this I'm going to be a bit sketchy about on purpose and draw more pictures and make more hand-waving arguments, because part of your homework is to do this more mathematically. But I don't know if the mathematics on the board gives so much insight. So I wanted to rather think about the instabilities of this thing at small u, all right, just qualitatively more. So again, right, so we have these, say, spin down feels the spin up as a external potential, right? So that's just not correct, but it is good enough for mean field theory, right? So now, in what follows, right, we're not going to try to argue that. So there's different ways of using mean field theory, right? So so one way is to treat it as a variational method. Okay, and really try to make hard comparisons about energies. So really say, let's propose a mean field wave function, so something that's a solution to this Hamiltonian with this interaction instead of with this interaction. So here you would get a complicated wave function. Here you get a Slater determinant, right? And you can use it as a variational wave function. But this is kind of unreliable, okay? In the sense of if we propose one mean field, right? So again, this depends on some, there's some assumed order here, okay? So we assume some order in the sense that we come up with different forms that these averages could have. We just propose them, and then we can get different variational states by proposing different averages. But this is kind of unreliable, because we could what we're going to do is we're going to look at a magnetic instability where we get a spontaneous separation of ups and downspins in real space, right? So the upspins will sort of hang out on one side, and the downspins will hang out preferentially on a different site. And we could compare that to the state where that doesn't happen, but that's not so reliable. So instead, we're going to take a different approach of saying, let's propose some order, some ordering, right? And then just figure out which is most favored, okay? So we're going to give up on one thing, which is that we're not going to actually be able totally to discover that ordering is favored at all. We're just going to say, if there's ordering, what would it be like most likely? That's what we're kind of trying to ask, right? And that's really, a lot of times, the most you can ask of mean field theory, because the energies just aren't quite precise enough to really determine who wins, whether ordering wins at all versus just staying disordered, meaning kind of staying in a metallic state, okay? It's not always useful for that. But you can say, if there was ordering, what would it be most likely, what properties would it be most likely to have? And that's the level we're going to be thinking here, all right? So what we're going to do is propose, we're going to propose magnetic ordering, weak. Okay, and this means we're going to say, what if these averages were to take this form, and what we're after is what Q would be ideal if this was to happen, right? Right. So, and again, this is a really different angle than here. So I wanted to draw this contrast that here, at sort of infinite U, you're thinking first about local moments forming, and you're asking a question about, now if we introduce a little bit of T, does this, you know, turn into some interesting interaction in local moment space? Like you can kind of think of the world now as existing of spins, and then introducing T couples the spins as spins, right? Here we have densities, right? When we start out in the metal, we just have, you know, some density of up electrons and the same density of down electrons, right? This is in a uniform translation invariant system. And now we're asking, is this unstable to some kind of situation where the up density is going to look like this, and then the down density is going to look like this, right? So we're not saying that immediately the spins are going to snap to some site. It's not like an upspin is just going to snap onto one site and a downspin is going to snap onto another site. What we're saying is that they're going to start undulating maybe a little bit. This may or may not happen, right? But there's some kind of you know, 2M modulation here. This might start happening, right? Where they'll sort of say, okay, you kind of start taking those sites, I'll start taking those sites, and they start sort of divvying up the sites, but very gradually. We want to think here as M is small, all right? And then we just want to ask, you know, what Q is sort of the best Q or the most likely Q if this scenario was to transpire, right? That's what we're after.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So there's other things you could propose. There's, I guess you could take, you mean the total magnetization you're saying, of the system? Yeah, so there are some assumptions in here, right? And I'm just choosing one possible instability. If you send Q to zero, you know, you could, this could describe paramagnetism, but then you have to be a little careful because some of the arguments I'm making become kind of singular and invalid, and then you have to basically start the analysis over. And there is such an instability that's sort of conceptually possible. It's called a Stoner instability at this level of treatment. But you know, then it becomes a matter of comparing energies and things. And in many cases, ferromagnetism is sort of notoriously hard to get in the Hubbard model. And I think in some cases, there's even theorems by Lieb about like certain 1D systems with short enough range interactions and you actually can't have ferromagnetism. There's actually rigorous proofs of certain cases where you cannot have ferromagnetism. So it's a very subtle business. Okay, what I'm trying to lead up to is basically that we're going to see there is an instability in certain cases for weak anti-ferromagnetism to occur, right? And part, basically, just to give you guys a sense of where I'm going with this today, is to say that anti-ferromagnetism is not only a sort of infinite U phenomenon. So you can see it there, but in certain cases, there's a whole there's sort of a whole crossover from one way of seeing the origin of anti-ferromagnetism. Well, I mean, the word anti-ferromagnetism even is a bit loaded, but seeing some kind of magnetic order at wave vector pi develop in one kind of weakly coupled picture and in a strongly coupled picture, right? So what you would call anti-ferromagnetism might come with a sense of having local moments. This will go under a different name somewhat, so I'll tell you that, right? So let's think now about what we've done is we've introduced interactions and then we've removed them out. You know, there's no longer interacting systems, right? So there's only a mean field level interaction. So what I mean is that if we now think about what are the up electrons experiencing, right? So there are, it's like a system of N over 2 spinless fermions. Of course, they're not spinless, right? But I mean, mathematically, right? They're same species fermions, same spin fermions, okay? Same thing mathematically. Spinless fermions in some potential V sub J, right? And again, you're going to work all this out more mathematically on the homework, I believe. But this is to give you a feeling of like, what's the point of the mathematics, right? What does it mean, right? So that means that we now have sort of two Hamiltonians for our system, one for the upspins, one for the downspins. I mean, the Hamiltonian's a sum of them, but let's just take one of the two in the sum. Okay, so I'm suppressing the spin label, right? I'm just putting it over here, saying this is the Hamiltonian that describes the ups, and we're not going to write the one for the downs. It's the same, basically, right? So suppressing it, we could put it here, but it would just be the same. There's no sum over spin or anything, right? So there's only one species of fermions, but there's also now half the number of them. So let's carefully think about what kind of band structure they would have, right? I mean, what filling and band structure and everything. So the band shape should be the same because this, you know, has the same form as usual for 1D Hubbard model. Right, so now the point is that these are like sites that can only hold one kind of spin. So we don't, now these are singly filled points, but there's half as many of the particles. That's kind of the idea, right? That's why I emphasize that they're not really spinless, right? So maybe don't take this too seriously. This is just mathematics talking, right? So I didn't want to confuse you by saying that. I just meant to say that they're same species fermions, right? Okay. So don't take that literally, right? I just meant mathematically they're same label species, right? Okay. So for instance, if we have a single particle level, we can put two fermions that have different labels. These don't even have to be spin labels. They could be orbital labels or something, right? We can doubly, we can put more than one. This is a statement about Pauli exclusion, right? If we have some orbital, we can put an up spin and a down spin in it, or an A spin and a, or an A fermion and a B fermion. That's right. Yeah, because what we did is we did a crude approximation that turns 4C operator, so this is like a C dagger C, C dagger C. And it just turns it into something that only involves two C's. So that's like a potential and a number, right? Yeah, question? Yeah, the V's are just fixed numbers that we propose, and we try, and then we propose a different set of V's, and we try again. Yes? Oh, yeah, that's a good point. So this is the picture of V. Thank you. Yeah, this is Vj equals 0. What we're going to do is propose different Vs and see what they do to this dispersion. That's a good point. So I didn't want this picture. This picture is only describing this part of this Hamiltonian to begin with, just so we have a good starting point. Right. Single particle energies. The reason I wanted to be careful about this and write this all out is to say that it still fills up to kF equals pi over 2, right? You might think that that this would shrink, but there's sort of half the number of degrees of freedom at every point, right? So that's the idea, right? So, yeah, that's right, because these are sites that can't hold as many fermions. That's the point, right? So now we have a different kind of local Hilbert space on our lattice model, right? In this picture. So now let's just think about, right, so you guys should know from the core class that there's this theory of free fermions in a weak periodic potential. Right? So this is just band theory from the weak potential point of view. We know that if you have a periodic potential with wave vector Q, that what happens is your dispersion will change and a gap can open, or will open, at near points connected by Q, right? That's the idea, right? So again, here I'm first thinking about, remove all the fermions from the system, solve the single particle problem over again with a weak V that's at some particular Q that I'm just proposing, right? So here I'm proposing a small Q. Solve all these single particle levels, and what you'll find is that a gap will open here. But the point is that let's think about some cases, right? So this is a small Q picture. Right? But we have a certain number of fermions that need to go into the system, right? So what will happen is we'll fill all these levels, okay? And then we have to also fill these, right? Up to some point. Because I'm thinking about, taking all the fermions out, doing this treatment to figure out what band structure we have, putting them all back in. And you see that some are going to go down in energy, but some are going to go up in energy in this picture, right? This is just a cartoon. It can all be made more precise. And then let's think also about a large Q and draw a picture, right? So here we have a gap that's going to open very high up. And then when we put all these fermions back in, the same number that we talked about, this n over 2 number, right? They're all going to be down well below this gap, right? Oh, broke the chalk again. Okay. Means we're halfway through the lecture. Whenever I break the chalk. All right. So, right. So again, this can all be made more precise, and this is going to be your homework, is to make this a bit more precise with some numbers and some more analysis. But the idea, right, is that here we have a weak effect, right? We have sort of a weak effect because weak effect on the energy because, you know, some of these states will benefit in energy, but some will pay, right, of the states that we actually need to occupy. Here, you know, they may all go down to some order, you know, m squared. You can work out the exact numbers. So there may be some kind of order m squared downward shift, some very tiny downward shift. But again, it's a very weak effect, right, because the Q is too large, right? And then for those of you who are being more careful thinking about this, I'm sort of sweeping a little thing under the rug, which is that overall introducing this term, even at this mean field level, is going to raise the energy. But the point is that there's a certain amount of raising of the energy that we cannot avoid, right? There's a certain amount of sort of classical kind of Hartree type energy that is just going to be there no matter what. So what we're asking is, since we're going to have to pay that amount anyway, is there any sort of rebate we can get, some savings we can get back by paying this sort of repulsion, but then getting a little bit back by also at the same time starting to develop this kind of weak magnetic wave through the system, right? That's what we're trying to figure out. So what we're trying to say is, if we could get a rebate, some savings, by letting this order start to develop at some Q, what Q would it be? So let's finally argue what's sort of the optimal Q. If we choose, here's my proposal, right? If we choose Q equal pi, then we can shift all occupied states downward, relatively downward, right? There's some other additional, you know, kind of classical energy that's just going to be there no matter what Q we choose, right? So we can shift all occupied states downward. And we can shift, we can say that the biggest downward shift will be where the density states is the largest. Okay, so we'll get the most for our money in a sense, right? So that it's Q equals pi, and I'll draw a picture just to motivate why that would be the best choice, right? And it's just because Q equals pi is the wave vector that spans our Fermi surface, right? So up here, it's the thing that reaches from minus KF, should have written minus KF, to KF, right? So it's the thing that goes all the way across. And you can see that then when we go and fill these levels back with the proper number of fermions, that they're all on this lower branch. And that's not the most important thing, actually, so much. Or, I mean, that's important, but I mean, these guys don't feel much of a shift. They're down here. These are the ones here that feel a big shift. Right? So you see there, the bands bend over quite a bit. And also, if you make a map of the density of states, I mean, even in the original bands before they're modified, you know, it's a lot larger there. So the density of states is much bigger here than here, right? So density of states is just where you just take an energy window and you just say how many of these discrete levels fit in that energy window. That's density of states. It's some kind of summary of the band structure without the K information, right? Yeah, so another way of seeing this, what this band is doing is that, just again, it has to do with counting of things. So basically, there's some, what we've done is we've said there's some potential that, let's say, is the down potential. And then what we do is we put up electrons into this proposed down potential, right? And the idea is that these are like same species. Okay, same species fermions. So as we know, right, if we take equal up and down fermions and put them into a periodic potential, right, if we have an even number per unit cell, that's like a band insulator. Here, since they're same species, if we have one per unit cell, that's the band insulator version of spinless fermions, right? So this is like a kind of band insulator. I'm putting this in sort of three quotes. I mean, it's not exactly like that, but it's like a band insulator, right, at mean field level of just loosely, right? But I'm trying to give you the intuition of what's going on. The band insulator of the up only fermions, right? And you could say the same thing about the down-only guys. So what we've done is we've introduced interactions, but then we've managed to sort of deal with them in a weak coupling picture. I mean, in a sort of almost a non-interacting picture, right? And this kind of, so what you end up with is that the density of the up guys staggers with the downs, right? And it doesn't go to zero here, right? This is supposed to be weak, so this is some overall, you know, this is the scale of like, here was sort of n over 2, right? And then just a weak oscillation starts to develop. So this goes by the name spin density wave order. And it's often abbreviated SDW, right? Okay, so you get some kind of spontaneous doubling of the unit cell at this mean field level, and that's like a band insulator, it's like a single species band insulator in some sense. Right. So then we see that interesting thing happens, right? All we talked about, right, was we talked about magnetic order. We said, let's propose magnetic ordering. Let's just see if that saves energy relative to having to introduce this U anyway, right? And I haven't told you whether this happens necessarily at infinitesimal U or at finite U. Though in this case, it actually, well, it's subtle in 1D. I'll tell you a little bit more about 2D in a second. So you can't always say whether this is beating not having the order with this mean field argument. But what we can see is that if there is some U where this starts to happen, what we get out of this argument is at what wave vector it should happen. That's mainly what we get out of this argument. Okay. We also see that if this density of states is large enough, it might even happen right away for sort of for small infinitesimal U. That's the other thing we somewhat intuit out of this argument, right? So we could also have run this argument at a different filling and everything would work, at least in 1D. There'd be some other magic Q that would reach across, but the density of states would be smaller, so the overall strength of this effect would be down, right? So these are sort of different things you get out of this picture. So what we see, interestingly, is that we propose magnetic order, and we also get hand-in-hand a charge gap, right? So we didn't set out to see, I didn't start by saying, you know, how can we obtain a charge gap? I set out to say, can magnetic order develop? But then as a byproduct, a charge gap just came along with it, right? Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I don't remember exactly, but I believe that's right, yeah. I'm pretty sure for graphene, you know, I haven't gone and looked at the exact, you know, exact calculation maybe that people have done, but I'm pretty sure, yeah, there the density of states is vanishing at the Fermi surface, and so you would expect there to be a finite U you would reach until this scenario would happen. So what I'll say in a second is that on the square lattice, I can say for sure that that at zero temperature, you know, this does happen because there's a very strong, very large density of states, and we'll see in a second. I'll draw a picture of that, right? Okay, another name of this thing is this called nesting. Right. So nesting is a pretty generic thing in 1D and 2D and 3D. It's much less generic, but it's still important to be aware of. Right. So again, nesting is just saying that there's one single, I'll make this more precise in 2D. There's one single Q that somehow reaches across every point on the Fermi, or a large number of points on the Fermi surface. It's a bit hard to see in 1D because it looks so obvious that there's always some Q you can draw that connects these points. 2D, it's much less obvious. We'll draw a picture and see. Okay. But just a few more words. A system that has a charge that develops a charge gap for this reason, okay, is called a Slater insulator. And so I just wanted to emphasize this point that that just because you are talking about the Hubbard model doesn't mean that the insulators of the, you know, insulating states of the Hubbard model are Mott insulators. Sometimes that's a bit of a misconception. So there's also a weak coupling picture of a charge gap developing. Right, so a Mott insulator is a much more subtle thing that is not tied to magnetic ordering. Magnetic ordering can come as an instability of it. Here, they're tied together; they're bound together. If you have the only reason you have this charge gap is the magnetic order. You know, they come in for the same reason, basically. That's the idea here, right? So it's a qualitatively important distinction to realize. Question? What's that? Maybe I don't need to. It's just that the real system is interacting. Yes, maybe I'll keep the quotes, because the point is that it's a band insulator picture of an actually interacting system. Band insulator is a non-interacting concept formally, right? So the idea is that bands themselves are essentially a non-interacting concept, right? Because what you're saying, what bands are, is you're saying that we can tackle a many-body system by putting in one electron and seeing what it does. Then once we figured out the fate of one electron, then we can just fill the whole system up and make its wave functions out of one electron states, right? Here, it's formally not true, right? Formally, you can't make the wave function that way. So the wave function is not of that kind of form, of a band insulator form. But going to some average band insulator picture gives us the right physics, or some potential instability that could happen, right? Yeah. Yeah, this is why I wanted to bring it up, because it's a subtle point. So let me show you. Well, let's see. So I was going to get to a case where this becomes more sharp, but I wanted to say a few more things about higher dimension. So let me punt on that question, and then we'll come back to it, and I'll have a picture I can point at. Okay. But it helps to go through. We're going to go up in dimension now a little bit. So I'm going to say a bit about 1D, 2D, and then we'll talk about 3D, and I'll draw a picture, and we'll make this distinction a little more clear. All right. And then I wanted also to set this up, because then what we're going to do tomorrow and Friday, and maybe a little bit on Monday, is talk about local moment magnetism, in the sense of we'll write down the Heisenberg model and then variants of that. And that the point is that there you can have magnetic order, but it's starting kind of the whole other way around, right? And that goes back to this board. So the Heisenberg model picture of things, I mean, I don't want to overemphasize this, because maybe you can still develop spin models for other situations, often the picture of why you wrote down the Heisenberg model is that you imagine that U is dominating everything, so that, you know, empty sites at half filling, I mean, empty sites and doubly occupied sites are just out. They're projected out. You have spins. Then you say, okay, the charges are so boring, we don't want to do anything with them. Just get rid of the charges. Focus on the spins, right? That's the picture here. Here, you know, we're seeing that there's waves in some kind of, you know, two different spin densities. So it's a much different picture, right, of some kind of anti-ferromagnetism that would start from pinning down electrons and then seeing what their spins do, some instability that their spins may have towards starting to lock together. So we're different angles on things. These aren't always, there's not always a very sharp distinction. That's another important point, right? So Mott insulators are very subtle things, because sometimes, you know, it's not clear if a system is adiabatically connected back to, or may be clear actually that it's sort of adiabatically connectable back to this. And so then it's a bit fuzzy whether you'd actually ever say such a system is a Mott insulator. We'll say more about this. So in 1D, this argument is a bit misleading, which we're not surprised by, because it's 1D. And mean field theory is known to work worst in 1D. So mean field theory, there's a statement you hear where they say it's exact in infinite dimensions, right? So this is the idea that things like critical exponents become correctly predicted by mean field theory above a certain large enough set of dimensions. Basically, mean field theory is what you're doing is you're relying on that the neighboring sites have a strong influence on one site, right? And so the more dimensions you go up, the more neighboring sites you have, and the better the arguments get. 1D, therefore, you only have two neighbors. It's like the least you can have almost, right? I mean, one or zero is the least, but you know, that's the least you can have in some simple system. So it's pretty misleading. But I'll just say that it's interesting that, so exact, for this 1D case where you have the Hubbard model half filling, you add a small u, exact results so this comes from most famously this thing called beta ansatz, where basically you propose a form for the wave function and then do some algebraic solution of the coefficients. Also, you can see this physics from DMRG, which is a numerical technique that works extremely well in 1D. Is that the spins remain disordered, or basically there's no magnetic ordering, okay? I hesitate to say spins because it's not always clear that there's like local moment formation in the weak U limit, but there's no magnetic ordering. But interestingly, in 1D, in this case, even for small U, a charge gap does immediately develop. Okay, I think this is important to know, because even though 1D seems like a bit of a toy, 1D is often where you can develop a lot of intuition for kinds of phases and states that can exist in higher dimensions. So if we make a plot of what the gap looks like just qualitatively, it opens immediately, but it's very small, and then it shoots up. So it kind of looks like this in 1D. So this is the gap, charge gap, of a half-filled 1D Hubbard, okay? For U over T, right? And then up here, the gap has to be proportional to U. Well, just say proportional to U. And you can see that by just thinking about isolated sites. And you put an electron in the system, and it basically gains no energy by moving around. So it just hangs out on whatever site you put it on. And essentially, there's just a loose argument. So then it basically just pays this U to have to go into the system, because it has to land somewhere, essentially. So you can see that the gap, this is just a rough argument, but the gap should go linearly as U, and then you can make that more precise. But down here, it opens very, it's a very slow opening of the gap. But it is finite. And interestingly, the mean field argument even gives the right opening for the gap. But in the end, it's the wrong conclusion, because the mean field argument says that there's also magnetic order developing, whereas in the real system, somehow the system sort of, you can think of it maybe as developing magnetic order and the gap. But then the magnetic order gets killed, but then like the gap remains. It's a little funny. So something like this. So it might be some kind of quasi spin density wave, maybe something like that. So, but really, there's a more subtle field theory argument. Kosterlitz, Thalers, that you can make to see this slow opening. So 1D is a bit special, and there are special techniques for dealing with things. So now let's go up in dimensions and see the fate of this kind of story there. And this will bring home some, makes more clear some of these distinctions about energy scales and what to call certain things. So now in 2D on the square lattice, the Fermi surface looks like this. It may still be up on one of the other boards, but I need one I can draw on. So here, so we saw in this 1D case, we found that our optimal Q is one that pushed down all the occupied states, right? Meaning opened a gap above but near all the occupied states, right? So you know, above wasn't good enough, because if it's above but very far away from the occupied states, it was only a very tiny downward shift. So we needed to be above and sort of right above. And also we want to open up this gap, this sort of band gap, we want it to open where the density of states is the largest to have the biggest effect. So if there is a certain Q that can do this, and then especially if it's the same Q over big, big patches of the Fermi surface, so we can see that there is a Q that we can take here and then just slide along this whole region, and it always perfectly touches both ends of the Fermi surface. So now you can even think along each of these lines roughly that 1D picture that we drew. You can almost think of this as happening along each line, you know, a little gap opening. And the density of states is very large all along the Fermi surface. Okay, so I'm shading this in to emphasize large density of states. Then this is you would say that this is a nested Fermi surface. And the nesting wave vector turns out to be pi pi. So pi pi means that, you know, on the square lattice, A sites will just start developing preferentially upspin and density, and the B sites downspin. So it's just this staggered kind of checkerboard pattern. All right. So it's like a checkerboard pattern. Well, let's just say checkerboard spin density wave. I'm a little hesitant to use the word anti-ferromagnetism, because then that kind of, to some people, that might convey more of a local moment starting point. So basically, another name for this checkerboard pattern is sort of nail order starts to develop. Okay. And so then, just to make a contrast, this is very special. So in 1D, it's a pretty generic situation that you can find a queue that will span across. Yeah, you could have chosen it the other way. I believe, yeah, I think it ends up just giving you an equivalent picture of the same order. Yeah, I think you open the gap actually all the way around. Yeah. Yeah, and I think probably just by some reciprocal lattice vector argument, you end up saying that it goes the other way. So, what if we did a lower filling, even on the same lattice? What if we did away from half filling? Just to emphasize, this is a bit of a special scenario, right? So it may not even happen on other lattices. Then the Fermi C is going to start looking a little more rounded. And then, maybe you can choose some, you can propose some Q here that would have a strong effect, but then that same Q over here is going to miss and not connect points with very large density of states. Okay, so this is not nested. Okay, and so indeed in this system, this 2D system, you really do get this instability for the 2D square lattice. So that then the argument works better. Okay, so I only have one more quick thing to say to wrap up today, just to draw a picture for you guys and talk about it. And then this will help us to segue now into spin models for tomorrow, Friday. And we'll do a little bit more exotic stuff, too. But I think this is interesting to make these distinctions. So now let's think about the three-dimensional cubic lattice Hubbard model, half-filling, okay? So 3D because I want to talk about finite temperature, and there's this thing called the Merman-Wagner theorem that is going to kill magnetic order at finite temperature in 2D. So it's just not as interesting to talk about finite temperature there. So I just wanted to go to 3D to make things a little more sharp, so I can actually talk about the existence of magnetic order even at finite temperature. So then let's make a plot, just a rough qualitative energy scale plot. And let's think about half filling, and then we introduce a little bit of U, then basically there's a little bit of magnetic order that develops, this kind of spin density wave scenario, right? So there's a spin density wave, and along with that, the system becomes this Slater insulator, right? So this is this weak coupling picture that a little bit of magnetic order starts to develop, and along with that, a band gap immediately opens. Or a gap, a charge gap, but has sort of a band-like picture. So then at finite temperature, so the point is this is a very weak effect. This is even, you can even show that the gap opens exponentially slowly and has an essential singularity. This is what you'll see in this homework. Okay. So then, a little bit of temperature kills this thing off. And when you kill one order, you kill the charge gap together. They're sort of tied together at the same energy scale. They're both weak. So then you just go to a paramagnetic metal at finite temperature. Okay, fine. So this scale grows and grows and grows, and then at some point over here, let's think from the other side. So now on the other side, at t equals zero, this is now this local moment picture, okay? Local moment just means that we think about cranking U up to infinity, and what we do is we pin down spins on each site. So now we project out charge degrees of freedom, and we just have a model of only spins. And the spins start interacting. They have some kinetic exchange, which you guys have worked out, which is J is proportional to T squared over U. Okay, so here we get So all along t equals 0, we have anti-ferromagnetism. We have some kind of nail order in the system. But the thing is, the magnetic order dies off at some energy scale, right? So the thing is, temperature tends to kill things once it reaches some characteristic energy scale of that effect, right? So this is just a general bit of knowledge, right? So just heuristically. Sometimes these energy scales can be suppressed from what you would, you can't always read them off of the coupling. We could talk about that. Sometimes the energy scales are suppressed by frustration and lattice effects, but in a simple lattice, like cubic lattice, you can read the energy scale off from the coupling. It's just a bit of general wisdom, right? So if the coupling has some value, that's also the temperature at which this effect will go away. That's on unfrustrated lattices, right? So the idea is that we can draw the shape of this energy scale at which this magnetic order is going to go away, and it's going to go down like this because U isn't the denominator, right? So here it grows because you need more U to start getting the spin density wave, so it grows. Here it falls away because the more U you have, the weaker and weaker these local moments are talking with each other. They're preferring just to ignore each other and just sit there. And so this scale goes down. So then just connecting these in the most general way, you get a peak like this, okay, just a rounded peak. And so this is interesting because over here we have a spin density wave picture. Here we have kind of a local moment AFM, anti-ferromagnet picture, right? But in practice, there's not really a sharp distinction here between these. And this has to do partly with the fact that we're in this special nested half-filling situation. So you don't have such a sharp distinction. And this is what I was kind of now getting to your question. But interestingly, you can see that the charge gap just can keep growing forever, right? So up here, you have a charge gap scale that is going to start peeling away from the spin energy scale, okay, the spin interaction scale. So you get an interesting separation here where the charge gap becomes stronger and stronger and stronger no matter what as you increase U, whereas after a while, you kind of make the spin physics, the fact that there's an anti-ferromagnet order, that actually starts to get weaker again after a while as you make U very large because you start really isolating the spins, okay? So then here you get a... you get a, be a good name for it, a paramagnetic insulator. Okay, and this would be a finite T Mott insulator. I mean, I think when some people are talking about Mott insulators, they're interested in finding them at zero temperature. It's a bit more conceptually interesting. Because then you would have a lack of magnetic order just due to quantum fluctuations, and that would be more interesting. But here we've kind of cheated a little bit and killed the magnetic order by just cranking up some temperature. But the point is that the charge gap can survive for a while, even past that. So it's a very different kind of physics over here, but I wanted to emphasize that in here and here we've doubled the unit cell subspontaneously. The magnetic order here doubles the unit cell. Here, you know, again we double the unit cell, and so these can be sort of adiabatically connected. I don't like that word adiabatic because it makes it seem like you have to change things slowly. Just there's a path in Hamiltonian space where you don't encounter a phase transition. That's what that phrase, that poorly chosen phrase means, right? Okay, so does that also answer your question a bit about, in this case, the distinction is not so sharp. So there's a bit of a, maybe I'll end with mentioning some current research direction that people are pursuing. So there's sort of an open question a bit about, can we find a really sharp zero temperature scenario where you can encounter a metal insulator transition? So this line is meant to indicate a metal insulator transition. I believe it's just like a first order one in this case at finite temperature generically. We don't know exactly for sure, but this is like from a DMFT paper I found this plot, and that's a mean field theory picture. There's a question about, you know, can this kind of metal insulator transition that's not essentially tied to magnetic order, can that happen at zero temperature? And so there's an intriguing paper that was recently published, I think just like late last year, where going back to 1D, you have the 1D Hubbard model, and you have next neighbor T. And then you also have second neighbor T prime. And these are tuned to some special values to try to avoid any nesting. So you need the T prime to avoid nesting. So in 1D, when you have, you kind of play around with the filling and you play around with the, you have further neighbor Ts, you can avoid this kind of scenario where there's some kind of special wave vector connecting points that have very large density of states. You can avoid that by setting things up carefully. And then you also put in some exponentially decaying interactions. OK, so this paper is actually by Mishmash, is the guy's last name, actually, and Roger Melko here, and Matthew Fisher, Yvonne Gonzalez, some other people. Very interesting paper. Take a look at it. And what they find is that you actually have a scenario where as you crank, so this is very different from Hubbard at this point because you have exponentially decaying interactions. This plays a key role. So it's not just on-site you. Then what you find is that the system actually remains metallic up to a certain point. Something happens, and then up here I'm trying to think in 1D what exactly happens. So basically, it's kind of like an antiferromagnet. It's a bit subtle because it's a quasi 1D system. So I'm probably saying the wrong name for this phase. But basically, here they get a precursor of a spin liquid, so-called spin liquid. So this is a insulating T equals zero paramagnet. What they're doing is they're distinguishing different ways that the system is gapless. They're kind of counting different types of gapless modes. And basically, what happens is that the charge gaps out here, but the spin is still totally gapless. So the spin behaves qualitatively as if there's like a Fermi surface, but it's like a Fermi surface of spins, you know, in a 1D, kind of a quasi 1D system. So you have something that's like a metal of spins. And so this can also go by the name Bose metal, because spins are like bosonic things, right? So this is a very interesting paper. I encourage you to take a look. So it's easy to find on the archive. You just write mishmash, and then you get this paper, right? So very nice work. And I'm very interested to see if this, so it's a bit controversial whether this really happens, but they have some very intense DMRG calculations they did on very large systems. And they have some detailed arguments along with some field theory about this scenario. Negative U? I might just punt on that. I don't want to say anything misleading. So, I think you can get a flipped scenario. I think you can get a flipped scenario in like at least in 1D. Okay, I don't know about the dimensionality part, but I think you can get charge density wave without having spin order developed. So things can kind of flip around.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, in 2D and things, you can have a BCS instability with attractive interactions. I mean, in 2D and also in 3D, I think. So I just meant above 1D. You know, 1D is a bit subtle, but mm-hmm. Right. Oh, yeah, so that's a mess, right? So we know phase diagram for 2D Hubbard. I believe at half-filling, it's pretty pinned down because there's a lot of powerful numerical techniques that work at half-filling. So there are variants of Monte Carlo that can deal with fermions. So if you just put in fermions the naive way in Monte Carlo, it has this thing called the sign problem. Yeah, it's a mess where basically it looks like you get negative probabilities. Then you try to fix that by putting an absolute value sign around the probabilities and reweighting things so you still would get the same answer. Then you just find that all your weights cancel pairwise. Well, they should cancel pairwise, theoretically, but you're doing a random drunken walk through all this space of weights, and you only find, say, all the positive ones, and you might miss a bunch of negative ones. So your results just fluctuate for a long time, and they never settle down. So anyway, right at half-filling, there are techniques where you sort of combine Slater determinants with Monte Carlo as one way of fixing it, and then you can fix things. That was a digression, but basically we know pretty well the phase diagram at half-filling. Away from half-filling, things can get pretty wild. So you get superconductivity, potentially metals, insulators, but then you also get these messy things called stripes, where you basically get charge density waves, but they're not at some sort of exactly magic wave vector. They can be these very slow, charge density waves. It kind of depends on the filling, I think. Then there's interesting sort of magnetic order that happens in relation to the charge density wave. So you'll get something that looks like nail order. Then as you cross the charge density wave, the nail order will flip. It's a thing called a pi phase shift, and then it stays that way. Then you hit the next wave, and it flips again. and then you have sort of a metal along each stripe. So you can, this is a crazy phase. It's like almost like, you know, there's lines of metal mixed with sort of charged density wave insulator and then kind of flipping nail order. It's really complicated stuff. So a lot of things can happen when you go away from half filling in 2D. But anyway, tomorrow we're gonna head towards spin world. Yeah.